You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Natalie Spencer. I'm a behavioral scientist at ING, and I used to work here at the RSA in the social brain team. It's a real pleasure to introduce today's guest speaker, Professor Robert Frank. Bob is a professor of economics at Cornell University. He's been an Economic View columnist for the New York Times for more than a decade. And he's the author of several books, including Success and Luck, The Winner Take All Society, The Economic Naturalist, The Darwin Economy, and others. And these books have been translated into 24 different languages. And as if that wasn't enough, Bob has also been a Peace Corps volunteer in rural Nepal, the chief economist for the Civil Aeronautics Board, and a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, and a professor of American Civilization in Paris. In 2008, he received an honorary doctorate in economics from the University of St. Gallen. So, as you all know, today Bob is here to speak to us about success and luck, good fortune, and the myth of meritocracy. Please join me in welcoming Professor Robert Frank.
Thank you very much, Natalie. I'm delighted to be back at the RSA. I spoke here in 2011 when I had a book out, and it was a wonderful audience then, and looks like a nice full set of fresh faces for today's session. The book has a very simple thesis. It's that social scientists have learned in recent years that chance events, things we don't think much about, have an unusually strong influence in shaping our lives, much more than we realize. And successful people in particular seem more unaware of the influence of chance events than others, and that has policy implications that are of concern to us, or at least ought to be, so I will argue. The frontispiece in the book has this epigram from an essay by E.B. White published in the 1930s. When I came across it for the first time, I was delighted that it was from an essay published that long ago, because I thought that means it will be out of copyright. I can use it for free. And so I was, of course, dismayed when Princeton told me that I would have to pay the agent for the E.B. White estate $500 to use that one sentence. And in a fit of pique, I almost said, no, I'm not going to do it, just as a matter of principle. It seemed like an outrageous sum to charge for a sentence. But then I thought a little bit more about it. And so nicely captured the thing I was trying to write about, that I thought it would be foolish not to use that sentence for the love of $500. So one of my, or all four of my sons will get a little less when I die. They'll forgive me. We notice luck when it happens in a conspicuous way. So if you win the lottery, nobody has any trouble at all saying that person was really lucky. It's interesting that they themselves invent narratives whereby they used unusual insight and skill in picking the numbers that enabled them to win the lottery. But I think most of us recognize that the winners were really, really lucky. So when it's conspicuous in this way, we see it. There can be bad luck as well as good luck. This is an event that happened here in the UK some years ago. The man in the bow tie, that's Mike Edwards. I see faces in the room old enough to remember the ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra. He was the cellist in the founding members of that group. He was, by all accounts, a very peaceful and decent man. He was driving along a rural roadway in England when on the top of a steep hillside, a bale of hay that weighed 1,300 pounds that had been moored there somehow broke free of its moorings and started tumbling down the mountainside, gathering speed. It hit a berm. It catapulted over a high fence and landed right on the roof of his cab as he was driving by, killing him instantly. We have no trouble recognizing that he was the victim of bad luck. That's an obvious instance of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But mostly luck doesn't play out in such conspicuous ways. In the book, I chronicle multiple ways in my own life where it has played out conspicuously. That's why I think I'm interested in the topic to the degree that I am. I don't claim any special quality of perspicaciousness that I notice luck more than other people. It's just I was hit over the head with it in very blunt ways multiple times, and hence my interest in it. But Paul Lazarsfeld, who's shown here, a sociologist in the 1940s, explained that we don't notice the importance of chance events because they play out in very subtle ways typically. He coined the term hindsight bias. And he illustrated it with a very interesting experiment. He approached subjects and told them that a study had been done in which the aim had been to figure out whether it was men who had grown up on farms or men who had grown up in cities who were more able to adjust to the rigors of military life, which group did better when they were sent into the service. And he explained to the subjects he was interviewing that the study had found that it was men who had grown up on farms who adjusted more readily. The reaction of subjects on hearing that was the one he expected. Well, of course, no one was surprised. They wanted to know, why would anybody need to do an expensive study to find out that? And the twist, of course, was that there had been a study, and what it found was that it was the men from cities who were much better able to adjust to the rigors of military life. But his point in this exercise was to demonstrate that if you thought you knew the outcome, it would be a simple matter indeed to construct a plausible narrative that would explain why, of course, that had to have been the outcome. Life is complex. Each career, each life entails thousands, maybe tens of thousands of steps. Some of them are the ones we expect. Others are quirky. If any one step is different, all the steps that occur afterwards, which depend on that step, will be subtly different, and those differences ramify step by step. And so the tape, if we played it again, would end up somewhere very different from where it ended up this time. And we just don't think of things that way. We see an outcome, we explain it, and then we feel like we're done. My friend and co-author, Tom Gilovich at Cornell, a very gifted psychologist, with his collaborator, Shai David, I have been doing some research on an interesting asymmetry in the way humans think about headwinds and tailwinds is the metaphor that they use. Here's a suggestion. When you go home tonight, get on your computer and do a Google search on the term headwinds, and then click the image link at the top of the search bar, and up will pop images like these. They are unmistakable epitomes of the concept. We don't wonder what's going on when we see those images. We know exactly that they're talking about somebody leaning into a stiff headwind. Then, step two of this experiment, do a Google search on tailwinds. And you'll get gibberish. There'll be arrows, there'll be attempts to explain in detail, but there's just no economical way to portray the concept nearly as effectively as we can portray the concept of headwinds. And just as it's easier to represent headwinds in a diagram or an image than tailwinds, so it's easier to remember headwinds when we think about the course of our lives. Think about when you're riding a bike into a stiff wind. You're keenly aware of that fact. Every 100 meters you go, you become more keenly aware of the fact that you're battling against a headwind. Let the course turn around and put the wind at your back, and wow, that's a nice change. You're very, very much aware of it, but only for a few seconds. You pedal on with the wind at your back, and that's completely out of your consciousness before more than a few seconds pass. You've played Scrabble. This is from experiments done in the lab. Did you get good letters? People have been asked that. I got a bunch of I's and not a single consonant worth more than a point, they complain. What about your opponent? Oh, he got an X, a Q, a Z. He had all the great letters. Well, if you play the game many times, you'll get good letters and bad letters, unless you're paranoid. You have to believe that you'll get, on average, an average mix of letters. But people, when they're asked about this, report that they got bad letters and their opponents got good letters. And so when they lose, it was because they got bad letters. When they win, it's not because they got good letters. It was because of their skill. We can see that chance events matter through vivid examples in which they clearly did, taken from real life. I asked Princeton's very able publicity director whether people in the UK would understand a reference to Breaking Bad. She assured me that they would. So this was actually a passage in the book that I had a quarrel with my editor about. I wanted to call Breaking Bad the greatest TV drama of all time. And he said, no, that wouldn't do. We compromised. It's, I think, called in the book now one of the greatest TV dramas of all time. Anyway, I think the critics all really certified that it was an incredibly well-done series, and the success of it has been attributed to many factors, but one of the most important ones is the portrayal of the Walter White character, the leading character in the series, by Bryan Cranston. And it's an interesting story of how he came to be cast in that role. Vince Gilligan, the producer of the series, wanted to cast him straight away. The studio bosses, who were preparing to spend an awful lot of money on this series, said no. We want somebody with a reputation, somebody who's had leading dramatic roles and can help lure an audience. That's a reasonable position. And so they wanted to give the role. They had two actors in mind, John Cusack and Matthew Broderick. I still have a very hard time imagining Broderick in the role of Walter White, the brilliant high school chemistry teacher who's dying of lung cancer, who wants to leave a legacy, financial legacy, for his family, and realizes that his only practical way to do that is to manufacture methamphetamine, which he can do much better than the people who are doing it in the black market and sell it. Matthew Broderick? That's not Matthew Broderick in that role. But it turns out that neither man expressed any interest in the role. I wonder how they feel about that now. I was trying to do a little more digging about that, and I discovered that Cusack denies that he was ever offered the role. It must be painful to think that you could have been Walter White and you weren't. Anyway, the series was incredibly successful. It won Emmys for the best dramatic series in each of its seasons. Walter White was the best dramatic actor winner in four of the five seasons. He's the most sought-after actor in his slice of the demographic today, but he'll be the first to tell you if you don't get a lucky break, you're nothing in that business. The reason studio bosses didn't want him was that the role he was most known for at the time was the dad in a sitcom, Malcolm in the Middle. I'd never watched that sitcom. I didn't know who Bryan Cranston was, even. And if the other two actors hadn't turned down the part, I still wouldn't know who he is. He's lucky. Are we wrong to celebrate him as one of the most talented actors out there? No. No, we're not wrong. He's obviously really, really talented. I saw him do an impromptu mimicry of Donald Trump on a morning show a month ago. It was unbelievably spot on. He's a really talented actor, but except for getting a little bit of a lucky break at the end, he was in his mid-50s, we never would have heard of him. Everybody knows who the woman in the top left is. In the U.S., everybody would know who the woman in the bottom right is, too. I'm guessing fewer people know who she is here, and the ones who do would probably be more reluctant to admit that they know who she is than in the U.S., but if you don't know, I will tell you, she is Kim Kardashian. Kim Kardashian, as far as I've been able to tell, doing a little bit of research about her, has never done anything that would justify the amount of attention that is lavished upon her. I think if I would say she's famous for what? She's famous for being famous. Nobody would stamp his foot and say, no, that can't be right. That's what seems to be true about her. She's never done anything remarkable. She's just gotten to be famous somehow. What about the Mona Lisa? It's the most famous painting in the world. Why is it so famous? Well, art historians have been writing about it for a long, long time, and they've got hundreds of articles dissecting the details of the painting, explaining what the qualities are, X, Y, and Z, that account for the strange allure of this painting. But what about the possibility that the Mona Lisa is famous just for being famous? That's what occurred to Duncan Watts, a sociologist who visited the Louvre some years ago, and like most of us have done, queued up to see the Mona Lisa. You've got to elbow hundreds of people aside to get anywhere close to it. It's a small canvas. It's not very impressive, I didn't think, when I first saw it. Duncan Watts didn't think so either. He went into the next gallery. There were two Leonardos hanging there from the exact same period, using the exact same brush strokes that had been used in the Mona Lisa. That was one of the things that historians were commenting on. Nobody was crowding others away to try and get a closer look to those other Leonardos. What was it about this one? And so he did a little bit more research, and he discovered that for the first couple of hundred years of the painting's life, it hadn't attracted all that much attention. Then, in 1911, Vincenzo Perugia, a custodian at the Louvre, stole the painting. He tucked it under his cloak one night and walked out with it. It was a sensational event. It was covered in newspapers all around the world, which at the time had, for the first time ever, the technical ability to reproduce photos of it in their pages. And so all around the world, newspapers were carrying photos on the front pages detailing the theft of the Mona Lisa. The crime remained unsolved for 2 years, and there were periodic updates with photos again. And then finally, 2 years later, Perugia tried to repatriate the painting to Italy. He thought it belonged there. He tried to sell it to the director of the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, who, of course, turned him into the police. And then another firestorm of publicity, pictures all over the front pages of newspapers around the world. And except for that, probably no one in the room here would have ever heard of the Mona Lisa or gone to see it. That's a plausible hypothesis. I am not an art historian. I don't know if that's the correct reason, but it is not a hypothesis to be dismissed out of hand. In our book published in 1995, Phil Cook and I argued that the way incomes get doled out in society has been undergoing a pretty dramatic transformation. We used to need people to serve local markets, and so there was a brisk demand for hundreds or thousands of performers in each category. Now technology enables the best performer to extend her reach to serve virtually the entire planet in some cases. Once we know who the best soprano is and get a copy of her aria recorded, we can stamp out copies of that at zero marginal cost. We don't need a 4,000 strong troop of sopranos to go around and perform in live music halls. The best soprano, who may be almost indistinguishably different from the second best or even the thousandth best, gets paid a seven-figure contract each year for her performance. The second best, who's as good, so maybe even better, ends up teaching small children music lessons somewhere at a pittance. And so as a result of this change in structure, the energy now focuses on the contest to see who's best. That contest is brutal. It attracts thousands, tens of thousands of contestants. The best one probably won't win the contest, we've been able to discover by simulations. Think about it. Suppose we model a contest as a foot race. The fastest runner will win. It's all objective. What does speed depend on? It depends on talent and effort, mostly. Let's say it depends 98% on talent and effort. The other 2% on chance factors. Well, find the best out of thousands of contestants. That will be somebody right up near the top edge of the talent distribution. There will be thousands of others behind that person, most of them way behind, but there'll be a group, and not a small group, breathing down her neck, almost as talented. The top contestant, almost by definition, will have only average luck. That's because we selected that person on the talent and performance aspect, not on, so she might have more than average luck, less than that, but on average, she'll have average luck. In the group nestled behind her, there'll be quite a number who have been very lucky. Not, most of them will not be, but there will be some. And one of them will win the contest almost every time. In simulations where talent counted for 49%, effort counted for 49%, and luck counted for 2%, the average luck score, where luck could be any number between 0 and 100, was between 95 and 100 most of the time. If you win, you are almost certainly hardworking and talented. Yes, that's what the conventional explanations about success say. But if you hadn't also been lucky, you would not have won. You would probably not have won. This matters enormously because when people earn something in a market, they feel like it's theirs. Theirs to keep. I earned it ever since John Locke wrote about the inalienability of the product of man's labor. People, when they get paid something in the market, they feel like it's theirs to keep. That's not a new phenomenon. What's new is that what you get paid in the market if you're a winner is so vastly greater than what people used to get paid when they were a top performer in these markets. There's never been any moral claim that if you're a tenth of a percent better than the next best contestant, you should get paid 10,000 times more than that person. That's a very tough argument to try to construct. But the idea that you earned it, you competed for it, you worked hard, you feel entitled to keep it, and because you have a lot of money, you can buy access to the political system, you can lobby for lower tax rates on top earners. They have been doing that, and they've been successful at doing that, and so there have been, over time, in the developed countries, steady reductions in the top marginal tax rates, even as the winnings at the top have been growing exponentially during the same period. That's been a catastrophe in terms of our ability to provide public services and maintain the kind of attempt at a level playing field that we all claim we think is important in a democracy. If people would reflect just a little bit on the fact that they were fortunate to have been winners, this could change. Let me describe for you an experiment that illustrates the central idea. This was done by my research assistant, Selena Huo. She designed it and implemented it more or less on her own. It was an online sample of subjects. One group, she told, think of a good thing that happened to you and list three external reasons that it happened, things you had nothing to do with. And that group listed a supportive teacher, a spouse, or many mentioned luck specifically. So that was one group. A second group, she said, think of a good thing that happened to you recently and list three things you did to cause it to happen. So people talked about hard work and talent and what we would expect. A third group, she said only, think of a good thing that happened to you. Never mind why it happened. And then she asked each of the groups, they got a bonus for completing the survey. She asked each of them, would you like to donate some or all of your bonus to a charity? You could pick one of three charities if you did. And what she found was that the people who had listed external causes gave about 25% more to charity than the ones who had been prompted to list things they had done to cause the good thing to happen. There's a big literature on this. There are experiments that induce subjects to experience the emotion of gratitude. And once that emotion is being experienced by someone, multiple things happen. The person is happier. We have ways to measure that. The person is healthier using objective measures, physical symptoms, doctor's visits, and the like. The person sleeps better. The person reports better social relations. And other people like the person more. So all those good things happen. And in addition, this basic finding, they're more generous towards others. They're less determined to hold on to everything that came their way when they recognize that the reason it came their way wasn't entirely up to their own doing. President Obama gave a speech in 2012. It came to be known as the "You Didn't Build That" speech. He was reminding people that if they were successful in life, it wasn't as a result of just their own efforts. If they had a successful business, they'd ship their goods to market on roads the rest of us helped build. They'd hired workers the rest of us helped paid to educate. They were protected by police and firefighters that we paid for. So part of the social contract, he reminded them, is to pay forward so that others in the next round will enjoy the same opportunities to succeed that you did. That sounds pretty reasonable when you read the transcript of the speech. How could anybody find fault with that? Well, people did. The speech also contained a remark, you built a business, well, you didn't build that, and then he went on to explain, but they took that out and showed it to people. People were outraged. They heard Obama saying, you were successful, well, you're a fraud. You don't deserve it, and so on. That was not the message of this speech. But what we do know is that if you tell somebody who's successful that you've been successful partly because you had lucky breaks along the way, they get angry and defensive in response to that message. They don't want to hear that. I'll share with you something that I discovered quite by chance. There's a different way to tell people about the role of chance in their lives, and that's this. And I urge you to try it. Go to one of your successful friends and ask this question. Can you think of any examples of any good fortune that you enjoyed along your path to the top? The amazing thing is just shifting the frame of the discussion in that subtle way completely eliminates any trace of anger or defensiveness on the part of the person to whom you're speaking. They think about the question. They seem to think it's an interesting question. And you can see their eyes light up when they think of an example. They want to tell you about it, and they tell you about it in an animated voice. And that kindles the recollection of another example. And so they tell you about it. And before you know it, they're talking about investments that we ought to be supporting in order that the next group would have chances to do well. So try that. Ask. Don't tell people they're lucky. Ask them about their luck. You may not hear about examples of investment social investments we ought to be making, but you'll hear some interesting stories if you pose that question. I've been doing this for a couple of years. It's a marvelous exercise. I'll close with a simple thought experiment that hints at an answer to the question raised by some. Well, I think we ought to invest more, but I don't want to give up any of the money I've worked so hard to earn, because that would mean I'd have to give up things I really care about. I think that's people who believe that are subject to a very deep cognitive error, which I think will come through clearly in an example. So think about two worlds. There's a low-tax world. The rich people get to keep all their pre-tax income, or most of it, and they can buy a Ferrari Berlinetta, $333,000 U.S. That's got to be close to 300,000 pounds. So they're delighted. It's a great car. There's the high-tax world on the right. The rich people, because they pay higher taxes, can't afford the Ferrari. None of them has it. What do? Instead, they buy the Porsche 911 Turbo for only $150,000. Now, let it be said that the law of diminishing returns operates here with a real vengeance. That car has got every feature that significantly affects the performance of a car. If you spend twice as much, you don't get much in addition to what you had. Some would even argue that that's the better car in absolute terms. Forget that. It might be, it might not be. The point is they're very close. And if this were a separate world, who thinks the rich people would be less happy there than the rich people here? There's no frame of reference. You've got the best car, you're going to be just as happy. But that's not the end of the story. These people are paying higher taxes. Where does that money go? Many people think, the government's going to flush it all down the toilet. No, the government uses it to pay for public services. Maybe it wastes some of it, but so do we waste some of what we spend. It's going to be used to pay for public services, which will include the maintenance of our roadways. So here's the low-tax system where public services are held in contempt and given short shrift because there isn't public money to pay for them. Who's happier? The Ferrari driver who drives his Ferrari on roads riddled with foot-deep potholes. That's what we have in the U.S. Or somebody in a different regime driving his Porsche on nice, smooth, well-maintained roadways. This is a no-brainer question. Everybody acknowledges, well, of course that guy will be happier. So if you give up a little of your income to help pay for public services that we're now shortchanging, and you're already rich, you're still going to be just as happy with what you own, and it's going to be much more useful to it in the environment that we'll be able to support if the government has better funding to carry out the things we want it to do. That's the message of the book. I feel lucky to have survived multiple near-death experiences to be able to write this book and be able to come out and tell you about it. And we've got some time. I know Natalie has some commentary and questions, and we'll have time for questions from you too. But here you are in London. You gave up a chunk out of the middle of your day. There are lots of other interesting things to do here. I'm grateful that you chose to come and hear me talk about my book. So thank you very much.
That was fantastic. Thank you so much. As you know, I read your book over the summer and absolutely loved it. Talked about it a lot at work and with my friends. So it's just really great to have you here to be able to tell us more about it. So my first question is trying to tease apart something. You talk about luck as a chance event outside of our control. And on the one hand, that could be the country that you're born in or whether your parents are wealthy or well-educated, or it could be something like winning the lottery. The first one sounds a lot like privilege. And is it worth making a distinction between privilege and kind of pure dumb luck? And if so, would that change the story at all?
Yeah, I think there really is a distinction between those types of luck. The kind of luck that happened to Bryan Cranston, I don't know if pure dumb luck is the right way to talk about that, but it's by its very nature something that isn't subject to control. Things just happen. Certainly the Mike Edwards example where the bale of hay fell on him, that's pure dumb luck, at least as I think about events like that. And so we can have safety regulations. You have to nail your bale of hay down more securely. We can try to prevent bad things from happening. But good things and bad things will happen by chance. There's nothing we can do about that. But the things that flow from environmental factors are just as important, if not more important, than those. And those are things that we can control. I mean, we can control how much access kids from low-income families have to educational resources. You know, now in the U.S., kids from poor families or even middle-income families graduate with an enormous financial debt. That didn't used to be true when I was coming through. We have control over that, but we have to make investments to do it. No individual can control it, but as a society, we have control over that. My cook in Nepal, when I was in the Peace Corps, was maybe the most resourceful person I've ever met. There was nothing he couldn't do, but his meager stipend that he got from me was probably the lifetime peak of his earnings trajectory. There was just no opportunity for him to capitalize on his talent and energy in that environment. So I think failing to provide opportunities for people who have talent and are willing to work hard to develop their talents and to flourish is just so wasteful, and we really need to think of ways that we could raise the revenue to start restoring those kinds of opportunities.
Great. And it seems to me that there's a balance to be struck somewhere. So on the one hand, if we reflect on luck's role on success, that prompts us to be more generous, as you showed. On the other hand, having a belief in our abilities or in our agency can help us stay self-motivated and help us continue to work hard. So what's the right balance there?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think many parents tell their kids that, you know, you're in charge. The second in command to Warren Buffett, a man named Charlie Munger, had a remark that I took note of. He said, if you want to get what you want, there's one strategy you ought to follow. The best strategy for getting what you want is to deserve what you want. So if students ask me, what should I do? I want to make become an expert at something. It's hard to do that. It takes 2,000 hours, maybe it takes 5,000 hours. The experts themselves are arguing about how many hours it takes to become an expert. But what they all agree on is that it's a lot. And it's not easy practice, it's difficult practice to become an expert. But if you can find something you like, it'll be easier to do that. You know, so don't go into a field where you don't like it to begin with, but become an expert. And then lightning will strike. Maybe you'll get rich. But if you don't get rich, you'll at least be doing something you like. And there are ways to carve out a decent life, even if you don't have a lot of money. So yeah, I think there are ways to think about that.
Okay, great. And I'm really curious about whether it's been an easy sell or a hard sell, the idea of a progressive consumption tax. And if people, once they get on board with the idea of luck playing such a strong role, are they more receptive to the idea of that?
I go out to speak to alumni groups. Cornell sends me on the road occasionally to talk to graduates. And most of the graduates that I speak to are probably audiences fairly similar to this one. You know, they're obviously well-educated. They've got Ivy League degrees. They're progressive in their orientation. But once in a while, they send me to a hard right political jurisdiction, and the people in those audiences are I think initially more predisposed to be hostile to the idea of contributing more to the public purse. That's an understatement, actually. But after 30 minutes, and in conversations afterwards, they're totally receptive to the notion that, yeah, they too were lucky. Yeah, if I'd been born in Somalia, I wouldn't be sitting in this nice spot that I'm sitting in now. So I think, if you'll go on Amazon to my book site, you'll see more than half of the reviews are 5 stars, but the next leading category of review is 1 star. It's clear that some of the people who gave 1-star reviews didn't read the book, but they knew the message must be hard work and talent don't matter, it's all luck. I'm implicitly saying that you, Mr. Success, are a fraud. That's not the message of the book. If you have enough time, you can get past that initial reaction. I think the UK readers don't review books on Amazon nearly as frequently as US readers do. And so I've got 1 5-star review and 2 1-star reviews on the Amazon book site in the UK.
You got to change that. Great. I have a million questions, but that would be unfair of me to do that. So why don't we open it up to the audience?
Hi. I wondered if you think the volume of successful people that society can handle now is kind of being held back to 20th century levels. It's like we can only handle so many famous film stars and so many famous musicians or architects or whatever. Is there an argument that the size of the meritocracy in the world is actually being held back because we only understand what it used to look like, and we've defined it by that myth?
An interesting question. Are there maybe many more successful people out there than we can keep in mind at any moment? I think working against that possibility is the fact that success is often defined in relative terms. So what does it mean to succeed? It's to be in the top 10%. Well, this just in. There are always going to be 10% of the people in the top 10%, and that's true no matter what the technology says. So partly, I think we're in the same place we've always been on that score. But what's interesting and new now is that a countervailing trend to the winner-take-all market, where one best performer serves the entire planet, is that there are a growing number of niche markets. If they're winner take all too. You got to be the best at what you do to do well in those markets. But they're tiny. They're very targeted to particular interests and tastes. And so that's what I think we'll see going forward. That the internet will make possible all sorts of interesting pairings between those who can produce something of interest and others who are interested in that particular thing. In the old days, they couldn't find one another, but now it's going to be increasingly likely that we can make those matches.
So I sort of had 2 quick points to make. One, Natalie mentioned economics in a final question, and I thought I've read Piketty's Capital as well, and he makes related points to you, I think I would say, when he talks about how, well, he uses one example of luck as inheritance, and I thought with sort of Trump taking power in America, it appears we're at somewhat of an inflection point where sort of a center-right, liberal, low-tax, deregulation, economics are sort of fraying under pressure from both right and left. So I was wondering, does that make you feel more confident, or does it make you worry it's going to be replaced with something worse? And secondly, when you talked about the negative impacts of people coming to a conclusion that they themselves are responsible, do you think the decline of religion has played a role in this? Because you showed on the chart charitable giving, and obviously it immediately came to mind sort of the tithing of churches or the zakat of the Islamic faith. And I thought, do you think the decline of God granted me this and being replaced by I did it myself has led to people diminishing luck? I mean, basically I'm saying, do you think luck and divine intervention are 2 sides of the same coin?
So yeah. 2 big questions there.
Good questions. Do I feel worried about tax policy under the Trump regime? you know, the human race has shown its ability to exist under all sorts of conditions. If the rich get richer and the poor get a little poorer over the next 4 years or 8 years, we'll survive that. It wouldn't be what I would prescribe. But there are other issues where our ability to weather the storm are much more in doubt. I think the fate of the Paris Climate Accords is or ought to be of grave concern to everybody, and I'm concerned about that too. Religion is a big force, or always was a big force in people's lives. It encouraged the kind of values that I think would be consistent with the reflective musings I'm urging people to engage in. Humility was always a celebrated value in most religions I know about. Has the downfall of religion played a part in people becoming less humble about their achievements? It sounds plausible, but the answer is I don't know.
Hi. My question sort of follows on, I think, from that, because like you, I've lived in Asia, and I found people's attitude towards fate very different from the West. And for example, I was in Indonesia when 9/11 happened, and people were really shocked, but I was living in a country where millions of people had died unfairly and didn't deserve to die. So their attitude was, yes, it's shocking, but bad things happen to good people all the time. But obviously for the West, it was a really shocking event, and is still sort of playing out now in the way that other events, say in other countries, don't play out, particularly in the East. So I just wondered, do you think there's a different attitude towards luck in the East and the West?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good writing to the effect that culture adapts to encourage the kind of attitudes and values that are most useful for whatever mix of problems are most important in the local environment. So if you're in a place where material hardship is rampant, then stoicism is cultivated. If you're in a place that goes to war all the time, then courage is a celebrated virtue. So yeah, of course, there would be local variations in the things people consider normal or worthy of celebration. Absolutely.
I wonder if you could just ponder on the distinction between luck and risk, because a lot of people in the financial markets or investing rely on risk to increase their returns, and they are effectively embracing luck.
Yeah, the general rule in finance is that if your investment carries greater risk, it's got to carry a larger return. Qualified somewhat by the notion that if you can assemble a pool of assets whose risks are uncorrelated, you can end up effectively not facing very much risk. But yeah, there's in the background always a trade-off between return and risk. So the main finding is that investment advisors who claim to be able to beat the market, half of them don't. Half of them do by chance, half of them don't by chance. On average, they do about what the market does. So the best advice is not to pay anybody to do that.
I'd like to take you up on the car example. Who draws the line and where is the line drawn? Because you could easily say, if you're a bit further left on the spectrum, that nobody should have a Porsche either, that you could have a $20,000 Ford Focus, and that would actually be more practical with more doors and a boot, which a Porsche doesn't give you. So who decides?
Yeah, I certainly don't claim to have any inside knowledge that would enable me to say, yeah, that's where the line should be. But the evidence is pretty clear that at the levels the people at the top are consuming now, there's not much bang for the buck for what they're spending. So in the U.S., for example, the average wedding now costs $31,000. In 1980, in inflation-adjusted dollars, it cost $10,000. Nobody argues that the people getting married now are happier because they're spending $31,000. There's, in fact, a paper recently published that shows that if you spent more than $20,000 on your wedding, your odds of divorce are 12% higher than if you spent between $5,000 and $10,000. So my claim only is that at the margin, if the people who are at the top of the income ladder faced incentives to spend a little less, that they wouldn't suffer much from that. How far back do we want to scale to achieve the social optimum? I have no idea. Yeah, maybe you're right. I mean, we do know that in Britain, engines are taxed by displacement, I believe is correct, and petrol is very heavily taxed compared to in the U.S., and if you buy a BMW 5 Series, I see them on the streets here, they have 1.6-liter engines, many of these BMW 5 Series. For the people who don't care about cars, in the U.S., that would be considered a wimpmobile. 0 to 60 miles an hour, it would take an eternity for it to get there. But in an environment where everybody has small engines because they're responding to the tax, the car doesn't subjectively feel underpowered. Drivers are perfectly happy. So we know that there's a big margin there to work with.
I'm interested in what you're talking about in terms of sort of priming people by the questions you ask, by asking about whether they can think of a success in which luck had played a part. And I know that the American presidential administration at the moment has been, you know, pursuing how to get information from voters very hard, and they've been very energetic about that. And a lot has been coming out in terms of the research of how easy it is to prime people and nudge people to make the kind of decisions that you want them to make by asking them the right sort of questions in the right order. And I'm wondering whether, as that technology becomes more worked out and intelligent, whether the person who has the power to ask those questions can then effectively sort of create the democracy, the democratic answers, the democratic base he or she wants to create.
Yeah, we've always known that how you phrase the question, if it is a question, matters enormously. We can induce almost any answer we want by framing the question in a suitable way. I think it is really important to learn how to talk about the effect of inequality. I think in the U.S., we just are very bad at it. It always comes across as liberals whining that the successful people took unfair advantage and they got to the top by cheating and this and that. And there is some of that, but markets today are just vastly more competitive than they ever were in the past. They're more like the National Basketball Association. If you don't make the shots, they don't need you. You're gone in short order. The people who make it to the top in most markets really are good. They really do work hard. So I think to indict them as cheaters and frauds is just, of course, going to kindle their anger. They know they worked hard. They're going to resist bitterly that characterization of who they are. Why not accept what the facts on the ground tell you, which is that they did work hard and that they are talented, and then focus on whether that means they deserve to have 10,000 times as much as somebody who worked just as hard and was just as talented? Does that mean that they are entitled to keep every nickel and leave the public purse severely underfunded, even for projects that they care about? No. I think we need to learn to talk about how distribution is really an open question for society, and how it would be in the interests of the rich that the distribution be different from what it is now.
What I was asking...
I'm sorry if I misunderstood.
No, my question was that, for example, just because it's happened, let's talk about if Donald Trump was advised to have a certain legislation, he wanted to push that through, he could then use behavioral technology, as it were, to ask the right questions to make people poll in agreement and commit to what he wanted. And so you can effectively create a democracy that is strangely powered from the bottom but led from the top.
Yeah, we have to be worried about the attempts to control what people think and believe. Yeah, we know in the U.S. fake news has assumed an outsized influence over what people believe.
You've given us so many great ideas in the past, big ideas, winner takes all, Darwin economy, luck, or the role of luck and success. So what's next? What should we be keeping an eye out for?
I'm going to work on a book about Pigouvian taxation. This sounds like it will be the least successful book I'll have ever written, but the theme is actually interesting. It's that we could raise all the revenue we need to carry out the most grand social projects anyone has dreamed about if we taxed only activities that cause undue harm to others. So a carbon tax. You put carbon into the air. Why do you do that? Because it's free to do that. Putting carbon into the air has bad consequences for everyone. There should be a steep fee for putting carbon into the air. Congestion. If I get on a highway that's crowded, I may do that if I'll get there 10 seconds quicker than going by an alternative route or not going at all and going at a different time. But my presence on that roadway may mean cumulatively longer delays for all the people who are on the roadway of 5 hours. Why should my 10-second gain be translated into a 5-hour increased delay for others? I wouldn't go then if I had good options to substitute to a different time if I had to pay to get on the... In the U.S. now, sugared soft drinks is a big issue. Kids are getting fat. There have been proposals to tax sugared soft drinks. These soft drinks cause harm. There's no doubt that they cause harm. No parent has the goal to raise a child who will become obese and get his feet amputated because he has type 2 diabetes. If you have an environment in which all the kids drink 2-liter sodas full of sugar, then your kid is going to be more likely to drink those too. And a tax takes that into account by saying, yes, we have an interest in the environment in which we all have to navigate our way through the world. So that's what the book will be about. I'm going to meditate on other titles maybe before.
Well, I hope we can discuss that with you in due time. So copies of Success and Luck are going to be out in the foyer, and it is such a good book. I really highly recommend it. I'd like to thank everyone who came here today and everyone who's online, and please join me in thanking Professor Robert Frank.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.